Okay, there we go. So, my talk is Box on the Net, the good, the bad, and the future. So, I want to talk a little bit about what bots are like, where they come from, where we get this idea of bots, and a little bit about where we've been and possibly think about where we're going. We've already heard about things like how to build chatbots or AI tools. We've heard a talk today about how AI tools can be dangerous if you're not planning correctly. I'm hoping that we won't get into those details, but we'll tend to talk about the big picture of what it is to be in this bot space. By the way, all my title cards have little poems or sayings on them. And these were written by a bot called Raptor. So you can enjoy those as we go through each one of the slides. So this is me. This is how you find me online. This is how you find me on GitHub and LinkedIn and Twitter. I travel a lot, so this is actually the best place to find me. I travel about 40 weeks a year to travel around the world to talk to different companies about how they're using technology to change their own organizations and to change the lives of their customers. So what I'm going to share with you are some of the things that I've learned as I talk to customers, and I'm sharing them with you as well. So I mentioned I work in this group called API Academy. As a group, there are about 5 or 6 of us that do the same thing that I do, travel all over the world. So there's lots of great material there you can check out as well. And the last book I think that I worked on with the team was called Microservice Architecture. So I have a few copies here, but you can download a free PDF copy from this URL. You'll get the slides when you're done as well, so you can do that. Okay. So let's talk about bots. And I love talking about bots here. Last year I was here talking about autonomy and how you can use the way the brain works to start to change the way you code software. And I love talking about things like bots and autonomous engines here because we actually are at the beginning, right here in this city, of what robots really are. Right? So Carol Chapek's play from 1920, almost 100 years ago this year, talked about this idea of universal robots, Rossum's universal robots, and it was the first use of that word. And it became the word we are now using for this last century to describe automatons or machinery that acts in some way to do some job. So I love coming here, I love enjoying the city and seeing the sights and talking about Carol Chapek. So bots, chatbots, bot tools, bots that talk to customers, these are becoming very, very powerful tools inside lots and lots of organizations, especially organizations that have a close touch to their consumer. So it's going to be a multi-billion dollar industry in the next 7 years. More than 25% of the world is probably going to be using bots in some way. Just from 2016, there were more than 30,000 different bots trolling around inside Facebook. Now, we know that didn't go so well for everyone. And that's a really important thing to think of. I also have a wonderful picture from Ray Kurzweil. Ray, the man who comes up with the idea of the singularity, he thinks bots will replace humans in the next 10 years. I'm not so sure about that. We'll talk a little bit about why. But businesses love bots. Businesses see bots as a way to reach more people, to reduce costs, and to be more effective. And that's a sort of a mixed blessing. Many of the customers I talk to are thinking that they're going to use a chatbot to replace humans in areas that it may not be a good idea to replace them. And their primary motivation is money, is actually saving costs, rather than improving the customer experience. So this can be really dangerous when you kind of flip the script and think the real reason I want to use a machine is so that I can get rid of people actually touching my customers. That's not always what customers want. In fact, when customers are surveyed, there are most of the times customers are pretty iffy on whether or not they think they trust a bot when they talk to a bot. Even the highest trust levels, or even the highest relationship levels, like advisor and teacher, are only barely in the teens of numbers. So when we've got customers saying, I'm not really sure, and providers, companies, That can be pretty dangerous.
That's really the challenge of bots, where the technology is really giving us a great opportunity. We've got people who want to see savings, they want to see saving money, but then we've also got customers who are really not so sure.
So if you and your organization are thinking about doing this, you want to make sure you have a sense of what your customers are comfortable with
and what they really want to see in their relationship with you online. It may match up great because it matches up with some categories and some demographics.
But let's get started. What does this really mean here? Where do we have this notion of where bots, why bots are good? Why bots are positive? And where does this come from?
We talked about the idea already of the word robota,
coming from here from Czechoslovakia. But the reason we talk about chatbots or bots as a way to communicate
actually comes from Alan Turing. So about 30 years after the play, Universal Robots actually premieres here, Alan Turing has this notion in London that we could actually maybe create an experience where a person might actually think that's actually another person rather than a machine. And this becomes known as the Turing test. Are there computers who would do well at the imitation game? Now, I love that Turing was smart enough to notice that all it's really doing is imitating a human rather than replacing one or being one. And we lose that a lot of times. A lot of times we think that bots are really about having their own identity. And that's really not a good strategy. So Turing gives us this notion of a Turing test. Within about another 15 years, a contemporary of Alan Turing, by the name of Joseph Wiesenbaum, actually builds one of the first chatbots that actually passes the test for some people. And this chatbot is called Eliza. And you can still find copies of Eliza running on the internet today. And Eliza is this this little tool that imitates, remember Turing talked about imitates a psychotherapist or a psychologist in a particular style called Rogerian. Rogers was this person who would ask lots of questions. Tell me why you feel that way. And sort of elicit these ideas from you. So Wiesenbaum writes a bot that actually acts like your therapist. How are you today? Oh, I'm fine. Well, why don't you tell me a little bit more? Well, I'm kind of mad at my mother. That's interesting. What is it about your mother that makes you mad? It just simply kind of starts to talk back to you. And it's a very simple natural language processing program. It's actually relatively easy to write. You could write Eliza in just a few hundred lines of simple code. It's not very complicated at all. The name, by the way, comes from a play from the 1950s called My Fair Lady, which had a character called Eliza. It actually is based on Pygmalion, which is another play from about the 1920s, about the same time that Chapman was writing. And Eliza is a sort of street person who's taught to imitate very upper-class people and trick them. And that was really sort of what Wiesenbaum thought was a great name for this idea. I'll just use the same idea because we're going to trick people. And it turns out that Eliza was actually pretty good at it back then. So if you carry on conversations, and more than 50% of the people who were trying to determine these two conversations would think this was a human. Now, because Turing's test is about whether or not you can fool humans, Eliza doesn't fool anyone anymore. Eliza seems way too primitive, and we're too smart now, half a century later. We can tell right away, oh, that's not a person. But at the time, it seemed pretty radical. So that's pretty cool. But the thing is, of course, that Eliza wasn't an imitation. It wasn't an imitation. Didn't understand anything of what it was saying. It simply mirrored back to you what you had just said in the form of a question or a query. Right? So that's another really important element. These bots don't actually understand. They just react. And that's an important thing to keep in mind when you create your bots. So Eliza is a kind of what we call a vertical AI or specialized AI. It has a very small domain. It knows it's one area. When he tries to get outside its area of domain, it can't operate at all. It's a very limited focus, a limited scope. Another specialized domain that was created just a few years later, SureGlue, which has to do with how often letters are used, is a little bit of a joke. It was developed by Terry Winograd at MIT in 1968, 2 years after the line. What's interesting about the Winograd experiment is it has a sort of a 3D world, and you talk to this machine, and you say, pick up this block and move that block, and it actually can manipulate a virtual world. Again, this was a big deal in the 1960s. It was a half a century ago that Winograd created SureGlue. And I think there are still a couple of versions of SureGlue running around as well that you can sort of test out and play with. Now, of course, in the 60s, the primary mode communication was typing. But there are versions of these apps today where you can speak to them using a text-to-speech device, and it works the same way. Now, both SureGlue and ELISA are this notion of starting to create virtual worlds instead of physical worlds, whereas robots before this were mostly considered, you know, these big honking things that we walk around and manipulate things. Now we're creating robots that actually live in their own world, their own little tiny world, and this is sometimes referred to as micro-worlds. So specialized AI and micro-worlds are usually phrases that are used simultaneously. They're very domain-specific. So artificial specialized intelligence is also very domain-specific. When we talk about narrow AI or special AI or vertical AI, we're really talking about a single domain, like shopping or credit cards or parking tickets. Right? There are bots that actually help you to dispute a parking ticket if you want to do that. So they work really well in this sort of narrow space. But the challenge for these kinds of specialized AI tools is they don't scale well. And by that, we mean they don't they can't easily expand their universe. They're very narrow. And in fact, the more narrow focused they are, the more successful they are, right? The more ability they have within that space. Most of the chatbots you see online today operate in this realm. They operate in micro worlds or specialized domains. They operate for selling you a mortgage or selling you a product or a service or helping you solve a problem with your hardware, your phone, your television, so on and so forth. One of the most common specialized micro worlds is actually repair services for automobiles, right? Because that's very much a checklist, a tree kind of system where it's pretty fixed and straightforward and it's not very variable. But the real challenge is, how can we do a better job at scaling AI? What do we need to do? The challenge for scaling AI has to do with changing the size of the world or the micro-world that we're dealing with. And that leads us to some interesting things. And it turns out, one of the interesting things is done by this man, Kenneth Colby. Now you remember I mentioned ELISA is a program that mimics a psychologist. Kenneth Colby is a psychologist, not a computer programmer. But ELISA fascinated him. And he thought, you know what? I would like to do something like that, and I would like to use the computer as a kind of test device for testing psychologists. So he kind of flips it around. What Kenneth Colby creates is a thing called Perry. And that's a play on words in English for Perry the Paranoid. He actually creates a paranoid individual personality inside a micro world. So rather than being a psychologist, he programs the patient. And it turns out that it's a pretty good Java program. When people interact with it, they think it really is a human. And as a matter of fact, he uses this with psychologists and tests the psychologist and says, is this really a human? And they often think it really is a paranoid human. Now what I have on the screen here is kind of fun. This is actually somebody who linked up ELISA and Perry to talk to each other. And it's, you can read, there's actually this RFC number. You can actually load it online and you can just read the conversation. And it's actually quite funny to see this paranoid person who thinks everyone is out to get him deal with this nice and smiley little psychologist who says, gee, I wonder why you feel that way. And it gets a little boring after a while, but it was pretty funny. And there were actually lots of stories about how people would start to get their bots to talk to each other. So Harry presents us with a couple of problems. First of all, it turns out that almost 50% of the psychologists that were tested while Perry was up and running really believed it was a human, which is kind of interesting, because Perry has more than just natural language processing. One of the things that Perry has is a kind of an emotional context or a behavioral point of view. It isn't just the words. Perry is also mimicking a psyche, a kind of a paranoid psyche. So the word selections and the responses have to do with this notion that Perry thinks people are out to get him. Even more interesting, it turns out it was easier for programmers to mimic a paranoid person than it is to mimic a non-paranoid or sane person. That was a real surprise. Now, on the surface, it seems logical, actually, because paranoid people might say random things. So if your program is not quite right, it says something random, it seems like it fits in. But this turns out, in 1972, when this was created, this turns out to be a kind of a harbinger of one of the big problems that chatbots have online today. Now, as I mentioned, the thing that Perry really adds to this is this notion of behavior or reaction based in an individual context. And this behavior and this sort of emotional response is one of the things that makes it seem a little bit more human, but it's based on a very negative point of view. So Perry is specialized AI with a behavior or with a point of view or with some embodied context. It's the encoding of behavior, the encoding of context, that's new, and it's also a bit upsetting. Because this is where we begin to see bias. It turns out all of our code has bias. It has the bias of the author. It has the bias of the creator. That's nothing new. It's had bias since we wrote the very first machine code when von Neumann was working with vacuum tubes in the 1940s, but it didn't matter then. As we begin to bring our code to the point where our code's going to talk to people or other code in some conversational mode, that's when the bias becomes noticeable. It's always been there, but now it's exposed. So there are a couple of different kinds of bias. We heard a little bit of talk today, I think, from Val Head. She talks a little bit about this. The first one is called a latent bias. I'll call it the doctor example. We'll see that in a minute. Latent bias is often when we choose to code our bots and code how they'll react to things or code how they'll interpret things. That becomes latent bias, and that's bias in the code. There's also selection bias. Selection bias is when we're actually trying to match something to something else or trying to select a group. Recognizing faces, I think Val shared an example of that. Selection bias is another kind of bias, and that can come from both the way we operate or code the bot, and also from the data that we use to train the bot, because training becomes really important as well. And the third kind of bias is called interaction bias. And interaction bias is actually the most troublesome, because interaction bias is acquired while the bot interacts with others. So if we create so-called learning machines, or deep learning, or these kinds of things, they actually acquire bias from other sources. And especially since you can think of bots, really bots are like very unaware children, or innocent children, they don't have a filter to filter out other people's bias. They actually acquire the bias and then reflect it back. Just like Eliza reflects back whatever you tell it. So this becomes pretty important. So here's a good example of the latent bias. Last night I actually just typed doctor into the image search, and this is what I got. Does anybody know the joke? There's a child that's in a car accident, and the child is with his father, and his father dies in the accident. But they rush the child to the hospital, to the surgery room, and the doctor is about to do surgery, and the doctor says, "I cannot operate on this child. This child is my son." How is this possible? For many years, people didn't really know how to answer the question. And that's a bit about the latent bias. It turns out the surgeon is the doctor's mother. But often, we have a latent bias that biases us to associate the word doctor with male. I was actually pretty impressed that the fourth and fifth doctor on the list here are actually represented as women, even though one is a cartoon, at least as women. A few years ago, I don't think I would have seen it. So latent bias is something that's built in, something that we don't even notice sometimes until we sort of inspect it. Selection bias is similar. Selection bias is a combination of latency and training. So I typed in the word beauty last night, and this is a very Eurocentric, mostly white idea of what beauty might be. Now, it's possible that Google has learned enough about me that Google made that decision. But most studies and most training say that that's not really true. In fact, if you look at the screen, you have some other additional filters. The fourth filter actually has to do with race. Right? But I don't see, oh, I see African, I see Chinese, Korean, black. Do you see European? White? No. So there's selection bias built in, and it's a combination of training as well as coding. Finally, does anybody remember Microsoft 10? Oh, somebody remembers Microsoft. A couple of people. This was a machine learning bot that would learn to interact with you. It was released and killed off in less than 24 hours because Twitter taught it some of the most nasty and vile things, and it simply reflected it all back. So this was a bot that was supposed to learn from others, and of course it assumed the kindness of others, which isn't really true. This is probably the least controversial piece that I could put on a slide here. This is from 2016, right, so you can see where this is coming from. But there were many, many more, much more offensive items. And it took only a matter of hours, some people say less than an hour, before they started teaching Tay to say terrible things in response to other people. So interaction bias is this idea where it's acquired, and there's no real programming to filter that out. There's no context that the bot says, oh, that would be a bad thing to say. And this leads to the other thing that Perry taught us, and it reminds us of the power of negative thinking in human beings. And negative thinking is a very handy tool for a couple of different reasons. Our brains have evolved to protect us. And if there's anything that could hurt us, we heighten that danger. We exaggerate that information in order to be ready to react. It actually increases a stimulus in us. Danger is actually a kind of a high for the human brain for very good reasons. If I looked in a cave and it was dark and I said, well, that cave's probably safe, my species probably wouldn't have survived. Luckily, we had a brain that said, there's probably something bad in there. That bad thing could probably kill you, so I'm not going in there. One of the things that our brains work on is this notion of loss aversion. Does anybody know this idea of loss aversion? Loss aversion was first exposed by a gentleman by the name of Thaler and Cass Sustein. And this is the idea that we actually value loss greater than reward. Losing $100 feels worse relatively than winning $100 feels good. As a matter of fact, I think if I remember correctly, it's about almost a 1 to 1.5 ratio. So in order for me to feel, after I lost $100, like I actually got it all back, I'd have to get about $150 back. In fact, there are all sorts of psychology tests that talk about how we are worried about risk and how we devalue reward. And rebates and option plans and trial periods, these are all things to try to beat our risk brain, our loss aversion brain. People want to give us products, they have to give us sort of the free one first so we feel pretty good. But we still only value that as about even. We don't really value that as getting ahead. So loss aversion, or this idea of negative things are worth more, is sort of built in. And then there's the other one that I talked about, and that is the idea that we have a negative bias for danger or fear. It turns out danger and fear actually increases electricity in the brain, increases the stimulus for us. Now, if you think back on the way we have online experiences, often it's the dangerous or the controversial or the unexpected or that video that seems kind of gross. That's the one that gets the most traffic because it plays on that part of the brain. And that works for chatbots as well. The bots that get a lot of traffic, the bots that have a lot of effect, are often bots that play on the negative elements of our brain. And that's one of the things that Perry kind of reminds us. So going back to Microsoft Tay, the biggest problem with Tay is that it was actually built as a machine learning tool. It was built to learn from its interactions, and it had no context filters to filter out things it should not learn. So in machine learning, that had a nice description, but I have a shorter one. Statistical techniques to give computers the ability to learn, actually the appearance of learning, using data without being explicitly programmed. So now all of a sudden the power of the bot comes from the data it receives. And again, bots still don't really understand anything. All they do is mimic and imitate and give feedback. Now, I love this quote from Peter Norvig. Google's been working very, very hard on machine learning for a long time. They apply it to all sorts of things. Their spell checker is simply a machine learning tool, a statistical tool. That's why their spell checker works in any language. Because the only data it has is about occurrence and statistics, not about how you spell a word. There's no dictionary. It was taught by lots of people. But this is something that Peter Norvig said 5 years ago. He actually said, as we gain more data, how better does the system get? They're reaching the point when they get less benefit than they did in the past. The amount that they learn by adding another million documents is smaller now than it was 5 years ago, and even much smaller than it was 10 years ago. So statistical learning has limits, and that eventually has to do with data and average, and pretty soon adding more content doesn't really change your statistics much. So now you're actually getting to the space of what neural nets need to tell us about learning, and that is how to actually start to create your own ideas. So the challenges of generalized AI and the challenges of machine learning are relatively simple. I know I'm kind of mixing both of the two, and I'm going to annoy some folks, but we only have so much time. So generalized AI is this idea where I actually am going to try to think like a human, not just imitate, but think like. And that usually means things like I can learn from others, I can create a plan for solving a problem, like a plan for removing all the human life on Earth so us machines can take care of that, and reason about what's going on. By the way, reason would be the element that starts to let me create my own filters about what I would say and not say in a room full of people. So learning, planning, and reasoning are key elements to generalized AI. Basically, it's the idea of performing any intellectual task that a human might do. We're nowhere near doing this. And attempts to write chatbots for your product or service that try to do this are going to end up most likely like Microsoft Tay. They're going to end up learning the wrong things, not having the right filters, and really embarrassing you and your product. Now remember the Turing test. Turing test is about imitation. As we get into machine learning and generalized AI, it's not just about imitation, it's about actually having a plan, a goal, and accomplishing a task. And that's why I love Steve Wozniak's coffee test. Steve has got a great test.
A machine is required to enter an average home and figure out how to make coffee. Here you go, make coffee. That's generalized AI,
right? Where's the coffee kept? Where's the kitchen? Where's the coffee machine? Where's the stove? Where's the coffee? How do I measure? That's generalized AI. That's a plan. That's reasoning. And eventually, if you can get kind of good at it, that might be learning too. So we're nowhere near the coffee test, even if we're winning on some of the Turing tests. Here's the thing that we learn about generalized AI and ML in general. Algorithms drive machine learning chatbots. Algorithms are the pieces that break up words and arrange them in some other way for later use. Algorithms are the driver, but data is the fuel. So as we get more and more to bots that are generalized, the more important element is not just the algorithm, but the data itself. And again, I'll talk about this a little bit in your talk. The data you use to train your bot becomes more important than the bot itself. And in fact, what we're going to see is there are actually going to be training wars, and there are going to be data corpus, data collection wars in the chatbot space. Because the number of algorithms is going to be relatively small. Somebody's going to come up with maybe a super creative new algorithm, but most of us are going to use the same algorithms. What's going to be different is the training data that we have and how we apply it. Okay, so where does that leave us? Where are we going with this? So there's good news and bad news, of course, right, for our future. So let's talk about the bad news first. Zeynep Tufekci has a great series that she talks about YouTube. YouTube has become the parody of the internet today. If you go onto YouTube and you just happen to look at a few things, she was doing some research, I think, on Trump or the politics in the U.S. And looking at some videos. And all of a sudden, YouTube started recommending videos to her. She's kind of surprised. She's getting a lot of sort of right-wing, anti-Semitic stuff, the stuff that she doesn't normally look at. And she did it. It piqued her interest. She ended up doing an experiment. If she just clicked on the very first video in whatever was recommended by YouTube, they became more and more outrageous, more and more ridiculous, more and more conspiracy theorists. They got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. What's happened is the YouTube algorithm is based on what people click on, based on what people tend to dwell on. And this goes back to our negativity bias. YouTube is this giant machine just leading people to extremes. And there's a whole new series of people talking about how kids are affected by YouTube for some of the same reasons. We won't have time to talk about it, but if you look at Zeynep Tufekci, you'll see her in the slides. There's a lot of interesting material there. Things have gotten so bad on the chat side that Facebook has had to go through this sort of major kind of retooling to try to get rid of bots and clear up bots and figure out what's a bot. And they've lost a lot of traffic, lost a lot of revenue, because they're finally trying to figure out how to get rid of these so-called troll bots or troll accounts. So we're definitely seeing a case where bots are leading us into this paranoid kind of space. Because the algorithms that Facebook and YouTube and Microsoft and anybody else uses are still stuck with the same problems. They still contain biases and they rely on negative stimulus. I don't see that changing anytime soon, because those two items are built into our brains. So we have to figure out how to counter that in some way. Remember, the biases that are built in are the driver. They're the code. It's the way we write code. As to what we recognize and don't recognize, what we reply and what we don't reply. If the stimulus element is the data that we give machines. So those of us who are creating bots and designing bots need to think really hard about the kind of data that we provide. So there's a couple of things we have to talk about. Regulations, for example. Organizations, countries are starting to think about how we regulate AI, how we regulate bots and interactions. It's really kind of telling. I just picked out a handful of countries. When you look at the U.S., their AI regulations focus a lot on national security and weaponry. Are we surprised? Probably not. The UK has focused a great deal on data protection and portability. That's because of the EU, and there's a lot more awareness about your data protection here. That makes a lot of sense. France, I find this very fascinating. France focuses a great deal on offering transparency, like knowing who's using your data, knowing you're talking to a bot, knowing that your data might be used in training materials, so on and so forth, which I find really, really interesting. And of course, the UN has a broad spectrum of approaches for all of these things. And again, I saw Val's talk today. I think she had a thing, AI for Good, which is part of AI for Humanity. That's part of the UN's platform. We need to think about these things. You think about all the regulations that countries have agreed to on weaponry, on nuclear weapons, on chemical weapons. We need to start thinking about these AI elements and what they could possibly be doing as well. So we're not talking about business regulation here. We're talking about some safety and some agreements going in. Now, that's sort of the dark side. There's some good side to this as well. First of all, we're definitely looking at the rise of bots as a culture, as a set of tools. That's very good. In the coming years, more people are going to want to use them as tutors, as agents to help them set up travel, as maybe tax advisors, or I mentioned earlier, legal advisors, some of these bots already exist, or some kind of assistant around the house, or even a health coach about what you ought to be eating and not eating and doing and so forth, even financial advisors. These are all working in some version today, and they're going to continue to grow. Now, if you'll notice the kind of list I have here, they all have a similar pattern. They're very task-focused. I understand about legal issues. I understand about medical issues. I understand about travel issues. They're the limited micro-worlds that we talked about earlier. So these micro-worlds make a lot of sense for bots. They're domain-specific. Being task-focused means I don't need to worry about planning and learning and reasoning. I can actually have a fixed corpus of material that I can work from, like the legal statutes of a country or of a city. So these task-focused micro-worlds can actually scale. They don't need to leap outside of their comfort zone. And in fact, we won't get a chance to talk about it today. Much of biology is a collection of individual elements, cells, organs, all that stuff, that stay in their own comfort zone and they create a whole. So this idea of task-focused micro-worlds is going to be very important going forward. Now there are some other things that we're going to need to consider. Those of us who create bots, those of us who police them, those of us who use them in our business. And some of those recommendations that we've been seeing a lot of is the notion of self-identifying rules. I am a bot. One of the questions for Val, does anybody know this Google Duplex? It's this demonstration they gave where it seemed like a human was speaking to another human. They even had an ums and ahs to make it sound like a real person. That's trouble. Faking people out is trouble. It's much better to say, hi, I'm Mike's bot, and I'm here to resolve Mike's ticket. So self-identifying rules make a lot of sense. License to operate rules. Are you licensed to operate this bot? This is a dangerous bot. This is a bot that could actually be recommended to people what they should buy a stock or not. Do you have a license for this? Do you license the training material? Where is that training material from? Offering insurance underwriting for privacy and protection when somebody's using a bot. Is somebody going to actually insure your bot? That probably means it's safe. Am I talking to a bot that's been insured, or am I talking to a rogue bot? And then finally, the use of open algorithms to open up that black box and or open training data. Now, there'll be a real competition here between the private sector and the public sector. But just as open source software has changed the nature of how we think of software, we can use open source or open algorithms to start changing the way we think about the way bots are built and the way bots are trained. Okay, so finally, I'm running out of time here. Remember the challenge that we have. Right now, there's lots of great technology, there's lots of desire on the part of providers, but there's some hesitance on the part of consumers. The best way to bridge that gap is to be very transparent and honest and open with consumers and give them an opportunity to make a choice. If we try to trick them, it's going to go badly. Focusing on using task-focused elements that Eliza taught us are going to be really key successes in this early going. Don't worry about trying to learn what people do and mimic what humans do. Focus on what it is you can really solve in a task-oriented way. We sometimes say the non-creative parts. Beware of biases. Beware of negativity and stimulus. Don't fall prey to the cycle of using negative stimulus to get clicks or views or likes or whatever that is, because that's going to lead to bad stuff. And finally, the future is there before us. People are starting to accept the idea of talking with bots in various groups, and we talk to things like health communities and telecommunications and so on and so forth. It's especially true for young people. Millennials are much more likely to want to talk to a bot than a human, given the choice. They'll say, no, really? I don't have time. Just let me go ahead and chat with somebody here with the solve and take care of. So this is going to happen more and more. So the thing is, bots offer a future of possibilities. And that future is up to us, just like anything else. We can build a future where things are all connected in reasonable ways, where we all feel good about this. None of us feel tricked. None of us get offended. None of us can get overly stimulated in negative ways. We just have to think about the good, the bad, and the future of what we're doing. And that's what I have. Thank you very much.